Honourable members, let's welcome Mrs. Pillay, the department delegation and the advocates for SANA. Mr. Seth Mguni, chairperson of Association of Community Advice Centers of South Africa. Mr. Langa Mchali, the chairperson, interim director of the National Alliance for the Development of Advice Centers. Mr. Simbongile Kache, CEO of ACAUSA. Mr. Kachile Nchenge, coordinator, Shared Legal Empowerment Framework, Open Society Foundation of South Africa. From our side, we have three apologies, Mr. Swart, Mr. Horn, and Advocate Simang. Mr. Self. I think we should all be happy to welcome the ACAUSA and all other associations, because these are people who are dealing with the concerns of our people on the ground, and the fact that they have been driving processes for change on their own under difficult circumstances is commendable. I once received an invitation to accompany them to Scotland. Unfortunately, I couldn't, but the Deputy Speaker, Honourable Sinoli, spoke highly about what happened there and the participation of the South African delegation, and I guess we will all benefit from that. I actually was thinking about your work when last week I met Professor Marquette Mason from the University of Natal, because we worked with him on these issues in the 80s. I was happy to see that he is still well and active. And he reminded me that in 1983, he was the lecturer of former Chief Justice Sandile Ngcobo, as well as the current Chief Justice Mokgweng Mokgweng. Now I realize that I'm actually very old, because when those two Chief Justices were still at university, I was already a professor and teaching law. But the things that I preached, like courts, community courts and paralegals, have not yet been realized. And those justices are even retiring. So it's like we are starting a question. And thank you very much for not giving up on these very important matters. Mrs. Pillay, we decided to invite you to come and give us a report, progress report, because we think that both yourselves in the department and these organizations, you have been working hard. Now is the time that we begin to see where the convergence is, so that we can bring some of these matters to a conclusion. It has been too long that we have been working on these matters. So I would like to leave the matters in your hands to tell us how we move forward. Just to say that we have some correspondence here, but that is the business of the committee. We'll deal with that after we have finished our deliberations.
Okay, thank you, Chair, and good morning to the honourable members and the guests at this committee. Chair, today we will be giving a progress report on the legislation to regulate paralegals. I will talk to that aspect of the presentation, and my colleague, Advocate Skosana, will talk to the progress report on community courts and the research we've done in that regard. We are accompanied today by Mr. Godfrey Ramaroke, and Advocate Skosana will introduce him when he starts his presentation. My presentation today will deal with the background and development of the bill, and secondly, developing a funding model for community advice officers, and to give a brief background on the work that's being done by the branch constitutional development, because in a manner of speaking, all these elements are linked to the development of the bill, and I don't believe that we've done a presentation on what the department is doing in other areas of its work in relation to community advice officers, and we thought that this is an opportune time to do so. I will move straight into the issue of the development of drafting legislation. Chair, initially when we started drafting a bill, which as you are aware is on the legislative program, our initial focus was to develop a concept paper and a bill to deal with regulation of paralegals in general. This included paralegals who are salaried employees and those who render services on a voluntary basis. Those who are salaried employees are employed in various sectors of the economy and are thus governed by the rules of employment in those sectors. The department is focused on developing legislation for paralegals who work on a voluntary basis in community-based advice offices. This narrowed focus is a result of the initial research being conducted and the fact that the sector is extremely broad, as I've indicated above. By virtue of the important role that community advice officers play in communities accessing justice and that these services are unregulated, this segment of paralegals has been identified as a priority area for the development of policy and legislation. The Minister, on 10th of April 2017, directed that a task team of role players be established with the mandate to develop a bill for the regulation of community-based advice officers and community-based paralegals, and two, to investigate the possible regulation of paralegals that give advice for their own account. The work we have done towards drafting the legislation, we've identified that we would require a regulatory body that would, inter alia, deal with matters such as regulation, discipline, and the registration of community-based advice officers and community-based paralegals. What requirements would there be to operate a community-based advice office, and the requirements to practice as a community-based paralegal, including the necessary qualifications? A draft bill, which deals with the areas that I will list below, has been drafted. It deals with areas such as proposals for the establishment of a council for community-based paralegals and community advice officers. Other clauses related to the council, such as its objects, membership, term of office, powers and function, registration of community-based paralegals with the council, minimum qualifications for community-based paralegals, issues of discipline, a code of conduct, the making of rules by the council and for community-based advice officers, and a clause for the funding of community-based officers which is to be developed. Developing the funding model. A comparison of statutes regulating other occupations show that regulatory bodies are primarily funded by its members in the form of inter alia registration fees. Although community-based advice officers and community-based paralegals play an indispensable role in access to justice, they do not charge fees for the services and currently rely on donor funding. Indications are that they would not be financially able to sustain a regulatory body and community-based advice officers. A sustainable source for funding for community-based advice officers and the regulatory body must be determined. The Association of Community Advice Officers of South Africa, ACOSA, during 2016 submitted to the department a draft bill as well as a policy document on the statutory regulation of CAOs and community-based paralegals. The policy document inter alia proposes that government should fund the CAOs and projected that the annual cost to government for the funding of 236 CAOs would be approximately 50 million at that time. The options for funding the regulatory body and CAOs. A document setting out the policy and options for the funding model is being developed by the department. The branch constitutional development is also addressing this aspect, which is working in close conjunction with the Foundation for Human Rights on a funding model. It is envisaged also that National Treasury will have to be engaged with regard to funding as well. The further work being performed by the branch constitutional development in respect of community-based advice officers entails the following. In terms of the sustainability of CAOs, the department has identified five key projects for supporting the sector. These are outlining the role of the department in supporting the sector, determining how the department can provide financial contributions to the sector, assisting CAOs to build governing structures, providing training to develop service provider skills in writing proposals, developing projects, managing budgets and office assets, providing leadership training and opportunities to network. The department is also looking at mechanisms of establishing a collaborative group of departments and agencies which can work closely together to detail the strategic support that government can provide to the sector. The departments that have been identified are National Treasury, Social Development, Department of Labour, Department of Cooperative Governance, and Department of Monitoring and Evaluation. The agencies that have been identified are Legal Aid South Africa, the Foundation for Human Rights, and the South African Human Rights Commission. The department recognizes that funding for this sector has declined with the withdrawal of many foreign funders and the reduction of available funds. The current position with regard to funding is as follows. About 100 community-based advice officers are funded through funds from the European Union by way of bilateral cooperation agreements. FHR administers two streams of funding to community-based advice officers. The first stream provides direct funding to 85 community-based advice officers. The second stream, under the Human Rights Awareness Program, funds 100 community-based advice officers to conduct campaigns. FHR provides 120,000 per annum to new advice officers who were not previously funded, and the contracts are renewable with a follow-up grant of 200,000 if the community-based advice officers complies with the requirements. Other sources of funding are the multi-agency grants, which fund about 43 community-based officers, the Department of Labour, Department of Public Works, the National Lotteries Commission, etc. There are several community-based advice officers that are funded by the Department of Social Development under the Victim Support Program. This funding is conducted through provincial departments. Although Legal Aid South Africa does not provide direct funding to community-based advice officers, it provides backup litigation support to 150 community-based advice officers and supports NAPCAO. The department's database illustrates that there are 348 functioning community-based advice officers in the country. In 2014, the Human Sciences Research Council conducted a cost-benefit study which modeled an annual funding of 236 community-based advice officers at a cost of between 250,000 and 500,000 per CAO per annum. The study proposed funding the salaries of four staff members, including covering costs for volunteer stipends, workshops, rent, transport, etc. The study concluded that governments may require a budget of approximately 50 million per annum to adequately fund all CAOs. The department is currently working with Donor Alliance, NAPCAO, and ECOSA to explore funding approaches as proposed in the 2016 research for funding options for paralegals and community advice officers. Developing the funding model for community-based advice officers is identified as a crucial step in this process. Chair, the link between the aspect of the funding model to the regulation is that if we create a regulatory body, the element of how would we fund the regulatory body becomes a crucial element, and therefore the two issues are linked. But work on the development of the bill is ongoing, as is the work for the development of the funding model, which my colleagues to my left are also part of those processes as well. That's all I would like to raise at this point, Chair. Thank you.
From those who are referring to all who are next, who is going to say the thing? There are two presenters. Education and that's what it is. I think I've lost two before we get started. Or there are two from the president. No, I thought we would begin with the paralegal first and then come back from the office.
Good morning, members of parliament.
Speak to the
Okay, my name is Langa Mjali. I'm the chairperson of the board of NATCEO, but currently acting as an interim director of NATCEO. Thanks for this opportunity to invite us to come and present before the portfolio committee on the work that we are doing. And I'm happy to speak after my colleague on my right has given a presentation on the modalities of how we can support the sector in its work. But we have prepared a presentation which we will ask one of our colleagues to present. And we are a delegation of four. And it's Mr. Mnguni, who is the chairperson of ACAWASA. Mr. Kamche, who is the CEO of ACAWASA, and our colleague from Open Society Foundation, Ms. Kaisile Tsenge. Just as a way of background, we were invited to come and present on the lessons learned from the Scotland trip that the chairperson spoke about earlier. And he said he couldn't attend.
The man displayed Mrs. Tsenge. She was sitting here, she was the first to arrive, and suddenly she was displayed.
I gave way for the presentation.
Oh, you gave way?
Yes.
Okay, that's fine.
Don't mind, I'm still empowered. Don't worry.
Okay. We will go through the presentation just shortly, which I will hand over to my colleague, Mr. Kamche.
I just want to know what is ACAWASA and ACAWASA and just abbreviations, I don't know.
Okay. NATCEO is the National Alliance for the Development of Community Advice Offices. It's an organization that supports the work done by community-based advice offices and paralegals. ACAWASA is an association that represents all community advice offices that are doing work on the ground. It's a membership organization. I think when my colleagues are presenting, then they'll be able to give more. But just in a nutshell, the two organizations play in the space of supporting community advice offices. Okay, thank you. Well. This presentation happens at a time when NATCEO is recovering from the loss of its seasonal director, Ms. Nomboni Sonango, who passed on earlier this year. And we were robbed of the opportunity that, as well, before she passed on, she wasn't able to be part of the delegation that went to Scotland due to visa issues. However, we have the benefit of having Mr. Kamche, who was part of that delegation from the sector, and he will be able to share with us the insight of what happened during that trip to Scotland. I'm happy that the cost benefit has been touched on the previous presentation, because the cost benefit is what triggered the trip to visit Scotland, because we were of the view that the work that we are doing is supporting what Department of Justice should be doing, and we, as a non-state actors, we are supporting that, and we believe that there could be modalities that could be developed to facilitate access to fiscals to support the work, because in the absence of the decline of support that we're receiving, this sector, the community-based advice office sector, could die, and then a lot of people will not have access to justice. So I'm ready to hand over to my colleague, Mr. Kamcha, to take you through the presentation. Thank you so much.
Thank you for the background.
Thank you, Mr. Mchali. Good morning, honorable members. It's a bit dark over there, but I'm glad that you seem to have pieces of paper in front of you. As I launch into this presentation, I hope that Mr. Advocate J.B. Skosana will be allowed to cross the floor just this once, because he was part of the delegation to Scotland. Thank you. This is the picture of the people who were there, minus there's one person who's not there, but we will see him. It's the deputy speaker, the Honorable Sinodi. There's JP. There's Fatima Hassan from Open Society. There's Wiswa Tsutumo from CS Mod Foundations. And then there's Brian Nair from Legal Aid. And then there's a short fellow somewhere there. This presentation is about the lessons that we gleaned from our study visit to Scotland. Mr. Mchali has outlined why we had to undertake that study visit. We wanted to pull lessons from abroad in terms of how other jurisdictions work on these matters. I wish to add as a side note that we also had an opportunity to have an interview with the Scottish Citizens Advice Bureau, which is basically an analogous association of advice offices in Scotland, in terms of how they work in communities and how they are funded by the Scottish Legal Aid Board, SLAB, which we call SLAB henceforth. The study visit was the culmination of long efforts by this sector to ensure its inclusion in the wider justice network in South Africa. And that Akaosa and Akaya would like to acknowledge the support that they have continued to enjoy from champions, institutional partners, and individuals who have supported this process all along. We indicate that on the second slide that over a long time we have tried to engage the ministry, starting from the days of the promulgation of the legal practice bill in its initial versions up to the final act, and that to this day that this work is now proceeding in two streams. One aspect focuses on the regulation of the sector, and the other aspect is focusing on the funding of the sector. I'm glad that the department is here and they have presented somewhat on these two aspects. And that there is currently a task team that was established by the minister, which is taking care of this work. And that there was this trip to Scotland, which was which took place sometime in September. And that there is also another study which followed, which looked into the actual details and the mechanics of possible funding models, which I think our colleagues from Justice Now might be privy to, and that study might underpin some of the work that they have referred to. the situation in Scotland is in some respects, whereas Scotland is within the UK, in a sense, Scotland functions as an emerging economy, as a third world country within a European context. So the similarities are quite strong. And also, I want to say that because that's what we were given. And that Scotland has, like the rest of the UK, has suffered the exposure to the EU, but also has suffered the financial meltdown of 2008, which has put extreme pressure on vulnerable communities. But what Scotland has done is tried very hard to protect their communities, especially vulnerable communities and refugees and migrants. And so they are a special case within the within the Union, within the UK. And that the way they are proceeding about the issue of legal aid is that they employ a mixed model of funding, which looks into state funding and also donor funding. They have a strong focus on ensuring that, emphasis on the justice outcomes, and that they employ a collaborative approach, which speaks to the involvement of all the players within this sector in the planning and coordination of advisory services. I will articulate later on who are those players. And they are also working to establish and use an overarching quality framework and the national standard, in as much as we are probably doing in our context, in a more explicit context by way of a regulatory framework. In Scotland, the legal aid was initially focused on civil cases, but later on it extended to criminal matters. It started from around 1950 on civil cases, and around 1964 it then expanded into criminal cases. The legal aid is governed through the Legal Aid Board, the Legal Aid Act of 1986, which created the Scottish Legal Aid Board, a non-departmental public body accountable to the Scottish ministers and responsible for managing the legal aid scheme. Scottish Legal Aid Board employs directly solicitors and also engages private legal firms and solicitors in terms of providing the services. In Scotland, legal aid is segmented as follows. Advice and assistance refers to initial advice to a person but does not include any type of representation in court. And then they have legal aid, which refers to the work required to prepare a case for a court hearing and in presenting and representing someone. They also refer to legal assistance, which is a combination of legal aid and advice and assistance. There's something which they call what is assistance by way of representation. In Scotland, all kinds of criminal matters which are in line with the European Convention on Human Rights are covered, subject to a merit and means test, up to a ceiling of, let me say, 26,000, or is it 25,000. SLAP also provides funding to citizen advice bureaus, which provide primary legal advice, and various community and non-state entities providing both primary and secondary legal assistance. Scotland has a strong emphasis on ensuring that the communities are protected from the vagaries of austerity, the tackling of poverty, and mitigation of the impacts of welfare reform. And that given the onset of the EU regime, that there is this thing of the transformation or reform of public services, but there is an interest to ensure and protect the services that go to communities, and that there is a strong bias towards targeting the causes of injustice and inequality rather than the consequences, and that they strive to make public services sustainable in the face of economic of an adverse economic climate. That picture is a group of paralegals from the African continent, from Malawi, Kenya, Sierra Leone, and colleagues from South Africa. This is the structure of the system in Scotland. You have private law firms and solicitors. You have the citizens' advice bureaus, and then you have non-governmental organisations. And all of these are stringed together by the Scottish Legal Aid Board, which acts as a funder, but also it refers cases to them. But it is important also to say that the Scottish Legal Aid Board, it also takes cases directly from individuals. And then in terms of roles and responsibilities, in the Scottish situation, we have the Scottish Parliament, which determines legal aid, rules, and fees paid to the legal profession. And then we have the Scottish Government, which determines legal aid strategy and policy, and it develops regulations that govern the operation of the legal aid system. And then the Scottish Legal Aid Board ensures availability and accessibility of legal services. It manages the legal aid system. It controls costs. And it recovers. It ensures that the contributions from individuals towards their assistance are recovered. It also manages different projects that deliver legal advisory services, and it also employs solicitors who provide the dual role of referring people to solicitors in the private sector and providing direct services. SLEP employed solicitors manage a 24-hour solicitor contact line. That means if somebody is in jail, that person has access to a solicitor without even having to apply. It's part of the role that they play. Key learnings. Scotland, as I indicated, implements a mixed model of advice provision. And there is a focus on helping people to resolve their problems earlier with the right advice at the right time, preferably outside of the formal courts and tribunal structures. SLEP is obliged to ensure the availability of duty solicitors across Scotland to ensure that accused persons are assisted in the earlier stages of criminal proceedings. In 2015-2016, SLEP supported 102 projects across Scotland under three main programs, reaching out to 28,000 people with over 45,000 cases dealt with. The funding came from across the Scottish Government and the Money and UK Money Advice Service, which caters for issues of debt advice and consumer advisory services. They combine monitoring information, which they are strong on the monitoring role, which involves narrative reports, client surveys, which look into the advice outcomes, and focus on issues of the financial outcomes, like how much money is recovered on behalf of communities, the retention of tenants, how protecting people from evictions, and testing how the level of trust of communities in the justice system, which I think is an important issue in the South African context, where communities tend to be alienated from the formal justice system. There is also cross-sectoral collaboration which links the health sector, local government, and they have had conferences that are looking into learnings, cross-pollination of learnings across those sectors, up to and including the fact that municipalities in Scotland fund the citizens' advice bureaus. What are the emerging proposals? This is, I think, the last slide. One, community advice offices in South Africa operate in communities and close the gap in the justice value chain, especially in rural and peri-urban areas. This is a point that we like to make. And that community advice offices have a vital role in advancing transformative constitutionalism and bridging the gap between the state and the communities. We say this thing because according to the Foundation for Human Rights colloquium in 2015, the level of understanding amongst our communities of the Constitution was sitting at something around 40%. And we make the case that if deliberate efforts were made to ensure that community advice offices provided awareness around the constitutional values, and that we ensure that communities embrace these values, that these values are not don't sit between the covers of a book of a glossy document. We say this thing because we are convinced that somewhere in the 80s and 70s and beyond, people, some of them in this room, were prepared to sacrifice life and limb in advancing the content of a document that has not even seen some of them, the Freedom Charter. We are saying that the Constitution of South Africa should be lived within the hearts of our people. It should be in our communities, and advice offices are a channel to ensure that this happens. We cannot hope that people will learn about the Constitution at the stage when somebody is standing before a magistrate or a judge, having violated the values of the Constitution through issues of xenophobia, etc., etc. We say that community advice offices afford communities access to services that normally should be provided by state organs, especially in the rural areas and peri-urban areas. That Legal Aid South Africa could function as a part of a two-tiered model of funding scheme comprising of Legal Aid and other agents of a multi-agency basket fund that works through intermediary organizations. Why intermediary organizations? Because if funding goes directly to advice offices, some of these offices might struggle to cope with the contractual requirements of reporting, et cetera, and managing the funds. But if we continue to use the intermediary organizations, we might cushion the advice offices from the stresses of having to account, et cetera. We say the Legal Aid Board because the public financial management environment in South Africa, the PFMA, might pose stringent barriers in terms of the channeling of funding, and the Legal Aid Board is an existing institution. We don't have to bend our heads thinking in terms of what could be created. The Legal Aid Board is positioned strategically to function as a distribution agent, channeling funds through intermediaries. We say that. In June, I was in the Transkei area. We have an emerging arrangement with Legal Aid in terms of ensuring that they support advice offices. The Legal Aid office in Mthatha already support, I cite them because I've seen it in practice, they already support advice offices. They provide them with furniture, they provide them with computers, they support them with training. We believe that This is something that works on the ground. But what is missing is ensuring that the advice offices also have funding, because those people have to pay, they have to pay rent, they have to keep people coming to the office either by way of stipends or even salaries. We propose a basket fund because we are looking into the idea of pooling state funds, but also funds from the donor agencies, some of which have begun to withdraw from the South African environment. We are looking also, we are strong on the preservation of the independence of community advice offices. We say this thing because communities trust advice offices, because advice offices are not part, or at least in the public eye, of the formal justice system. These are neighbors, these are people who have lived together. And advice offices, they don't, you know, when you are a judge or a magistrate, I have nothing against a judge or a magistrate. You issue, you pass a judgment. You go and sleep wherever you sleep. If you are a community-based paralegal, the solution that you propose between two disputants, you have to sleep with that solution in that village. And so you have to come up with a solution that everybody can sleep with. Mr. Seth Mguni here operates a community advice office in Mabopane, the Insu advice office. The Garankuwa Magistrates Court refers about 100 cases to them in a month. And most of those cases are through the court annex mediation processes. The resolution rate is 90%. People who go to the, who come out of the magistrate's court fighting, they come out of the advice office shaking hands and saying, man, why, what were we fighting about? Because the advice office is able to go to the root cause of why did you fight. The magistrate focuses on who slapped whose face first on Friday night. The advice office is able to drill down and discover that actually somebody married somebody's daughter in 1983, there is outstanding lobola, and the relationships have frozen, and then this led to somebody slapping somebody on Friday. And then you are able to resolve this thing from 1983 going forward. Whereas if you are a magistrate, you focus on who slapped whose face, and somebody goes to jail. Honorable members, I am... Oh, let me indicate that as part of this proposed solutions, we want to make the special plea, we want to take advantage of this platform to make the special plea that the local government sphere, especially municipalities, should be nudged to look into the question of providing office space and infrastructure, because this is a key factor of sustainability for advice offices. Some advice offices close because they don't have office space, because or advice offices sometimes have had to operate without funding for 10 years. A Mafefe advice office in Lebowakgom has not had funding for 10 years, but they are still in operation because somehow they have somebody's house from which they are operating, and they provide the service. But for those that are operating in urban areas, space becomes a critical issue. And we believe that if municipalities could come into play in Schumannsdorp, in Mabopane, in Lianra, they did, not anymore, and in other areas, municipalities still do provide space. We know, though, that sometimes when the communities erupt against the municipalities, there is a propensity to ban also that space that is used by the advice office. But we want to make this the plea. Okay, this is the end of the presentation. Thank you. I am wanting to invite any of my colleagues and also Advocate JP if he wants to chip in on the Scottish trip.
Thanks, Chair, and honourable members and members of NETCAO and colleagues who came with me from the department. I just wanted to add that the experience learned from the Scottish jurisdiction was quite enriching. And subsequent to that engagement, we've had discussion the legal aid South Africa, and we realized the opportunity that there is a space to enhance the scope and mandate of the legal aid South Africa to take care of some of the other aspects, and moving from the track record of them having maintain 15 years of a clean audit and looking for the 16th clean audit this year, I'm sure there would be less objections if they would be assigned that mandate of taking care of that. That process, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members, will basically engage substantive discussion at policy level, and that's what we have raised. that its structure and its format as it is now, it was basically more geared to give effect to the constitution and in terms of supporting indigenous people, particularly in terms of their criminal appearances, etc. To expand the mandate to look at issue of supporting community courts, access to justice, imperatives, etc., will require some additional mandate and legislation review of the legal aid itself. And we have said that it's time that we must start looking at that so that we can basically take into stock all those aspects which have also been raised by this committee. You realize, Chair, that as recently we have noted that the legal aid sector have never taken keen focus on the representation of indigent litigants in terms of land restitution matters. And their focus and mainly been on the criminal cases, etc., which basically omit a vast portion or sector of the community in terms of the whole area of restitution and establishing an equal society, etc. So we are looking at that as a full stop to see how it can be capacitated. When we met with them, the department, they said they will basically be amenable, provided one, their capacity is going to be enhanced, and two, issue of funding is going to be looked into. But they've shown willingness to take more than what they have currently, provided that the additional load is accompanied by the necessary capacity. The second point which I wanted to allude to is that legal aid already takes in paralegals as part of the core mandate today, as we sit now. They've got, when we met with them, they indicated about the 1,000 plus legal paralegals under their fold who worked under the supervision and guidance of the practitioners, etc., and which we found to be very progressive. And to the extent that we have paralegals and there's a process of regulations that we're looking into, etc., I think it will be important that we also look into how we continue to exploit their capacity to tap into a paralegal movement and the establishment of themselves with NETCAO will be very crucial. Other than that, we found that there are many similarities between the Scottish dispensation hours in terms of legal aid, in terms of the governance arrangement, the role of the minister, the funding models from the fiscals, etc. All those issues are similar in nature. And I just want to say that this discussion today are appropriate and well-timed in view of the dwindling financial support which have for many years been coming through the EU. We know that in the, I think that they are having their last grant to the program, and many of the good work that have been sustained through those funds will stand to collapse if we don't find innovative ways to sustain those functions, those services. And therefore, I think I've suggested to legal aid that they also need to start engaging directly with NetCow, et cetera, so that they start preparing for the time when the funds are going to dry up, et cetera. But other than that, I can elaborate further on the questions and comments that may arise from the honourable members. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much for giving the policy
the report and also concrete proposals as to what needs to be done. And I think that will help us move faster. Honourable members, you have heard for yourselves, Honourable Breitenbach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are we putting questions to everybody who presented now?
Yeah.
Okay. Then for Mrs. Delay, please.
Not only questions, but also start to engage and make your own proposals and comments.
You mentioned that the mediation officers will be appointed and there will be court annexed mediation, which is part of 712 sites, and rolled out. How far is this process and what are the positives and negatives of that up to this stage? Scottish Drift, I will ask Mr. Hansen. Also, the concept paper and progress in respect of consultation with stakeholders, can you just update us on that, on progress made there, please? And the timeframe for the introduction of pilot community courts, where are we with that? Just update on that, please. Then to Mr. Kante, or should I say the co-chair? I'm quite interested in that. In a 13-page presentation, 7 of them are taken up by photographs and or other odd pictures. And 6 pages are taken up with photographs and pictures, and only 7 contain any information.
Not photographs, it's role players.
Mm. So that's interesting. No, it's actually 7. You've 6. You can count them. I would like to know what role the deputy speaker played in this visit to Scotland, please.
Thank you.
I would like quite a lot of detail on that.
Thank you.
But I'm not done, so don't get excited.
Okay.
I would like to know, please, how the Scottish model actually compares against the South African model. I don't find that easily accessible in your presentation. How does the Scottish model compare with the South African model of legal aid? And having made that comparison for me, can you tell me, please, how can we improve the South African model? After your comparison and your visit to Scotland, what lessons did you learn from this visit? You mentioned that Scotland is an emerging market in a third world country, and then you quickly qualified it to say you say it because it's what you were given. You were there. I presume you were there for some time. How long were you there, just by the way?
1 week.
1 week.
Yes.
In your week in Scotland, did you experience it as a third world country in an emerging market? I find that really, really difficult to accept, understand, follow on any level. Then I'm also interested now, you went in September 2016, is that correct?
Yes.
It's now moving towards the end of August 2017. Why do we only hear about this now? It's a year later. Surely this important information should have been shared long before today. And the progress that you should have made from your visit should have been presented to us already. Why has it taken a year for us to hear about the visit and what you did then? We don't have any sense of progress as a result of the visit.
Honorable,
I'd like to have some sense of progress.
Honorable Grettenbach,
yes.
Some of the things you must blame maybe me.
I'm very sorry. Mr. Hans is a grown man. He was happy to take the chair with you, and he can answer that question. If he wants to blame you, he's free to do so. And then to Mr. Skosana. You say that... and I'm struggling to read my own handwriting. You say that the outcomes of this visit for you are supporting community courts, legislation review, and you must start to look over all of that, having had discussions with Legal Aid South Africa. How far are these issues down the line? I mean, has any progress at all been made, or is it merely starting? When were these discussions held? And then I'm interested to know if, and I don't know this, and perhaps you can help me. I don't have the Legal Aid Act here. You say that Legal Aid has not played a part in land restitution matters and has therefore omitted the larger part of our citizens. Does Legal Aid, does their mandate include acting in land reform matters? I'm not sure. Are they in fact enabled to do so? Or do we need to look at legislation, an amendment, in order to do that? I don't know, and I'm asking you if you know. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Honourable Member,
I'm terribly sorry, there's one more thing. Mr. Hamte, you talk about a basket of funds in which you want to pool state funds and donor funds. Did I understand you correctly?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so... would you explain to me what you have in mind there, please, precisely and more specifically with regards to the donor funds? Do you know, about 18 months ago, the public protector came to this very committee, the previous public protector, and made the mistake of making a passing mention of donor funds. Well, she got roasted. She got accused of all kinds of corruption and other issues by this very committee. So I urge you to be very careful when you consider this issue, and please explain to me precisely what you have in mind, because I'm terribly worried that the same thing is going to happen to you. Thank you.
Honourable members, I just want to request that we don't prosecute the presenters, but rather engage and make suggestions that will enrich their work and proposals. Honourable Matthias.
Thanks so much, Honourable Chair. Look, let me also welcome the presentations, but also highlight that among various concerns that we have raised in the previous meetings we had with the department, among those issues that stands up most are the two. One is the statutory recognition of the paralegal service in the country, in the sense that the current Legal Practice Act makes no provision or don't recognize the paralegal sector in the country. Two was the issue of the funding model. Now going back to the first one, non-recognition of the paralegal sector in this country. What proposals to come does the committee, the department table or propose before the committee to fill the void on the recognition or lack of recognition of the paralegal sector? we had hoped that in your presentation you will also cover that aspect. It's important that you have also undertaken a trip to Scotland. One of the things that we have raised in the previous meeting was that you should also look at African solutions. We have strongly recommended that you need to, as you benchmark and then take some lessons from other parts of the world, you also have to look at African solution to these questions. Have you ever done so? Over and above the picture that looks so good of your African colleagues and counterparts, there's no reference whatsoever on lessons learned from such sessions or interactions you had with your African colleagues. And if you do have, why are they not, why such lessons are not part of your presentation? What best lessons, best models, practices we can share from our African counterparts? Lastly, is about the what you highlighted in the presentation, Mr. Kamche, about the Scottish model on various interventions that it does, especially in relation to the retention of tenants. And Mr. Skosana also highlighted that, even expanded on that, that what has been lacking in the South African system, legal aid system, is lack or failure to provide financial and legal assistance for litigations around land restitution. And the matter which is receiving priority and attention. So in the context of the Scottish model, what forms of interventions or assistance is the system providing, especially in relation to tenants? What forms of tenants? Is it in the form of rental, or is it in the form of farm or farm dweller tenancy system, and how the Scottish government go about providing such legal and financial assistance to those who are unfairly treated? And if you have to take that to the South African situation in relation to land restitution, are there any measures in place to see to it that the legal aid South Africa do integrate in its system and in its funding model? Means and measures to see to it that litigants in the land restitution disputes have been assisted financially and other
Thank you, Mr. Matthias, honorable member.
Thank you very much for the presentation. That we've heard so far. Very informative. I wanted to find out if, just to understand on the, particularly the practice of the advice center, would you say, because we've got a two-problem system, if I'm correct, I understand that both the values and the substantive as well as the procedural law in the African system, different from the European system which we are practicing. Do you, as you are on the ground, do you find that conflict? And if so, how do you resolve it? Particularly, you mentioned that the magistrate would refer, the magistrate, of course, using the European system, approach of justice, and you referred to the advice center, where you start with the African perhaps, and do you find any conflict? If so, how do you resolve that? Secondly, I just wanted to find on the question of funding. Were you suggesting that it would, the government or the treasury, we put a budget within the legal aid board that must cater for the advice centers? Is that what you were suggesting? Thirdly, I just want to find out, you mentioned the question of constitutional value. I've got a problem with that. Are you suggesting that what the values that are in the constitution are actually said African values? African values. I'm saying in the constitution, which you would agree with me is a compromised document. Are you suggesting that when you talk about you in these advice centers, you're actually promoting the constitutional values? Is there no conflict with the African values, or are you saying the constitutional values are African values? Thank you.
Honorable Bongo, are you saying something?
No, I'm just greeting you, sir.
Oh, okay. I thought you were objecting to what the advocate Mpula was saying.
No.
Okay, now thank you for your elegance. Honorable Maila.
Thank you very much, Chair. Let me also start by appreciating both presentations. And maybe to say, the presentation by the department shows that you are responding to what we need, because I can see you are now at the stage where you are developing a draft bill to respond to what we always said we need to have: paralegals and community-based advice offices. So thanks very much on that. Now, I wanted to talk on the lessons learned from Scotland. But before that, the presentation here says there are 348 community-based advice centers in the country. My interest would be on how they are distributed in terms of provinces, also in terms of urban rural setup, because these centers are about access to justice, and there can't be access to justice if there is no accessibility to the centers themselves. I appreciate the proposal that says the local government sector, especially municipalities, should make it a point that they make these offices to be viable. But if you look at the setup of our municipalities, there are communities which find it difficult to access their municipal offices. So it's a problem. So I think maybe let me start by saying, how do you view the 348 offices? How are they accessible throughout the country? You gave an example about the office in Mabopane, that the magistrate's court refers cases. I would like to know if in other parts of the country the same practice maybe take effect. Because your explanation actually it was quite fine that, you know, cases where people should have been jailed were actually resolved amicably. That's something that we need to see happening from time to time. Now, the issue of Scotland. How are the conditions in Scotland? are there rural areas and urban areas like in our case? I'm not saying we can't take some cue from Scotland, but we just have to compare the setup of the two countries. More so that Scotland is almost an island. Am I right? It's almost an island. So I just want to share with us how the two differ. Yeah, I think, Chair, let me pause. Those are my issues.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me also take the opportunity of welcoming the two presentations on community courts and paralegals. And to say that indeed we are really making movement, because this is something that has been long in the pipeline, to have legislation that actually governs paralegal offices. And of course, the community courts, it's good to see that also gaining momentum. Taking into consideration also the challenges that we have in the country, high levels of crime and all sorts of cases that need attention. And indeed, what is actually also good is to be in the position to have a structured arrangement. That talks to certain issues like qualifications and issues of registration. That's very important in order for government to be in the position to commit, because what's important is if the department is leading this, it means you must have actually looked at the cost effectiveness of this, and I imagine that you think that we're going to be in the position as government to fund the paralegal offices. When you're making a presentation, you talk about something like 100 paralegal offices being funded by the Foundation for Human Rights. And then you stipulated other agencies, that is private business, that actually fund some numbers again of paralegal offices. Is that number realistic? Where are these private advice offices? And when you actually look at what you're saying the initial payment, when they make an initial grant of 120,000, it's followed by 200,000. The total amount is, what is the budget of the Foundation for Human Rights? Because when you make a calculation, it doesn't make sense. But anyway, my biggest worry here is whether South Africans feel these numbers of paralegal and advice offices that you're talking about. Maybe in future you can actually also indicate the distribution of these advice offices, so that we get to understand where they are based and how people can actually manage to easily access them. You made a suggestion that maybe local government must actually fund or organize space for paralegal offices. It's a good suggestion, but when you look at the numbers, you wonder whether it's going to, because you have about something like 290 something municipalities. And when you look at those figures, they exceed the municipalities. But at the same time, my worry is really whether South Africans can feel the existence of those offices. Do you talk about offices, even those that have closed down, or we're talking about active advice offices? It's very important. And coming to the Scotland trip, I would actually also ask, why is the report coming in now? It's very late. And maybe you should have, even if you have not invited us, you should have just made us aware that this was something that was in the pipeline, and send the report if you can't actually manage coming to the TTN Parliament. Because you know, when you say, when you present something that is old, you might be presenting something that has already changed in Scotland. Because if you say that it's actually been reported a year down the line, only now that you're getting that report. But for all intents and purposes, I think we are on the right track. What's important finally is to actually see ourselves being in the position to regulate paralegal work, so that it can actually be recognized and it can actually manage to get the necessary resources in the country, including the community courts. Thank you, Chairperson.
Not from myself. I just wanted to say that I think your report is very good. But, you know, unless we also have the benefit of our own situation, it can send the message that we are trying to transplant a foreign system into our country. Because this idea of advice centers for paralegal work, you can trace it from 1968 after the passage of the Suppression of Terrorism Act, when the South African Council of Churches raised money to support paralegals to help the victims then and their families. And then after the state of emergency of 1985, there were paralegals all over, for instance, under the National Public Interest Law and Research, when the idea of community law center was born. And the University of Cape Town did lots of research. University of the Western Cape did lots of research. So there's a lot of work that has been done in South Africa. So I think if you need a law, we'll also need, you know, we'll talk about the desirability of the law. A case has got to be made that such a law is desirable. And now don't assume that we will all understand and accept that. Don't expect that all the 400 members of parliament will be on the same page with us. So a case has to be made. But for me, the important part of that case would really be that in the same manner that the Roman Dutch people developed Roman Dutch law, informed by the experiences of their people and their people's sense of justice, the British developed their common law, informed by their people's sense of justice and experience. African people are no different. And in fact, because of the struggles they undertook, they even evolved a community justice concept. It's just that generally African people look down upon themselves and they prefer to advance other people's things other than the, their things. So I would suggest that you really look at the question of desirability against the background of the initiatives of our communities themselves. And also you made a point about constitutional literacy, which is a valid point, that our people don't know about this constitution and the rights, and you can apply a constitution to people who don't know nothing about that constitution. So that is an important role that we are highlighting. But also the whole issue of human rights awareness. You know, it's very disappointing that at the moment in the media, you have the case of the Deputy Minister of Higher Education. You hear senior people in government forgetting the simple thing that the law must be allowed to take its course. They already want to set the bail outside the court. They already want to say for how many days he must be sentenced.
there's so much discussion about this whole thing. So you can see that also from the middle class and politicians, they don't understand how the human rights system works. So it means you have an important role to play to educate our people on these human rights. But also, you were talking about the alienation of the people from the justice system. Because the justice system creates a conflict situation where there's a contest, and now the stronger person will win the contest, but that does not guarantee reconciliation and peaceful coexistence between the people. And in the traditional sense, you have what they call consensual model of justice versus the adversarial concept of justice. So that is a strong motivation why at the community level you need this system that you are talking about. But now there's also the question of the funding model. There's no reason why municipalities should not fund this, because most people who have problems at the local level go to municipal offices, and municipalities have offices in the townships, so those structures would be accessible through the municipality. Maybe in that regard we should engage SALGA and put this matter on the agenda of SALGA, that they also have a role to play. Then there's a legal aid board. I think you made a strong case there that they should come to the party. But something that you also need to clarify is why you talk about intermediary. Because we can also be running a risk of creating another huge organization which will need offices, which will need staff, so that the money that must go to the advice centers end up going into running another bureaucracy. So I think you should deal with that, explain it, and see if one's fears are not indicated. But during the apartheid times, you know, cities like Johannesburg, they had these citizens' advice bureaus. They funded them. And maybe we should find out why did that stop. And we engage SALGA that all municipalities must have advice centers or provide advice centers with the offices in the townships and everywhere. There's public Department of Public Works, which has so many unutilized buildings. And why can't they make those buildings available to ourselves? Lastly, there is, I think, law students must have an interest in this matter, because we are accused of producing unemployable law graduates, and some of these people could become paralegals, and it would be important that we begin to engage them now, get their inputs. I'm happy you have Foundation for Human Rights, but there's Dala Omar Institute, there's a Community Law Center in Pretoria, and now with the South African Human Rights Commission, I don't know if you have worked with them. There is Professor Majola himself, the chairperson, Advocate Amia Mia, Advocate J.B. Sibanyoni. These are the people who were actually the leaders of the paralegal movement in the 80s. So I think you could benefit a lot from engaging with them. But otherwise, thank you very much for the presentations. I think this will take us forward. Are there any responses you want to make to questions raised this side? We are proceed.
Thank you. I will Let me start by thanking all of the questions. They enrich the process, most certainly. I will take only a few of the questions. My colleagues and here will deal with some of the questions. From you, Chair, the last question that you raised was around students. I was fortunate sometime, I think it was in July, I had a meeting with the students for law and social justice at the University of Western Cape during what is called the public law, public interest law gathering. You were there. I met with these students. These students, the idea we have with them is that we want them to, and they have indicated an interest to be placed in advice offices as part of their experiential learning. In fact, NADCAO, in 2015 and I think last year, they placed some of the students in the advice offices in Gauteng, and I think Limpopo, can you tell you may want to, Mpumalanga and Free State as well, you may want to enrich that further. So we have a process of engaging law students because we have a phenomenon in South Africa of unemployed and unemployable LLB graduates. We believe that this situation should be addressed. It is unfortunate that the presentation of this kind could not address everything because most of the questions are touching on some of the work that we have been dealing with. Let me go to Utatutolo Pagutolo. It talks about the question of conflicts of African versus European values, red justice system. There was a similar question that speaks to African solutions. We actually are doing work. I think my colleague Babu Mchali will deal with that extensively. We are working with our colleagues in Rwanda, in Sierra Leone, in Kenya, in Malawi. He will talk about the conference that is happening next week, that we are attending next week in Kigali. I will not go there. I will talk to something that we saw, that we have witnessed. In Rwanda, after the genocide of 94, there was virtually no system of lawyers that could deal with the unfortunate events. They worked through what was called the traditional courts, what was called the Kachacha courts, the grass courts. These courts were village courts, and they used these courts, they trained and used these courts to deal with some of these cases. And then these courts were then graduated in what is now, was later called abunzis, which are mediation, village mediation structures, which basically mediate disputes at the village level. We were in Ramakwamana sometime last year, a small town north, is that north or east of Rwanda, of Kigali? East, yeah. I lose my bearings sometimes. We saw that paralegals convene meetings in communities. The advice offices, as is the case in South Africa, they have got offices in rural areas. But other than that, you've got barefoot, the equivalent of barefoot lawyers, paralegals that walk amongst the villages, operated work in the villages. On Fridays, they have special topics, themes, where they discuss issues. For instance, we were fortunate to attend a session where they were dealing and mediating issues of disputes between husband and wife.
Maybe what you should do, just talk directly to what you have
raised, because we are left with 1 hour.
Okay, thank you.
And we have to do another presentation.
Okay, thank you. I will gallop. We do actually work to learn from what is happening in the African continent, and to also learn lessons. For instance, in Malawi, paralegals work in the prisons, and throughout the criminal justice system. They start in court, in the police station. They follow the detainee from police station to court up to the time when they are imprisoned. Something that we are not exactly doing in the South African context, and we are wanting to learn from that. Let me jump to that question about the Deputy Speaker. The invitation was sent to, I want to believe, to the legislature, because the belief was that the legislature is about the participation of communities in governance, which is what is we are trying to do as the Community Advice Office sector. And so we thought that going to Scotland would work if we bring the Department of Justice, but also we bring the legislative arm. That means the executive and the legislative arm of government, looking into some of the lessons. I will not be able to go into all the issues. And we benefited a lot from the presence of the because we actually also had to go to the Scottish Parliament. We got a presentation from the Scottish Parliament in terms of how they work with communities there. In Scotland, a third world economy, we say we were told this on account of the nature of problems that communities are facing, issues of unemployment, issues of housing, etc., the kind of problems that people are experiencing. And the legal aid South Africa, I think there are strong similarities between legal aid South Africa and the Scottish Legal Aid Board, except that the Scottish Legal Aid Board has got a wider remit, has got a wider scope in terms of what they are doing, in the sense that they don't just provide advisory service, but they also fund the services that are provided by community advisory structures, but also they engage the services, which is basically what we are proposing in this platform. On retention of tenancy, mostly in the Scotland situation, the issues are housing. Are housing related, complicated mostly by the questions of migration, the refugee crisis, but also the fact that people, since the financial meltdown, people have been losing their housing, their houses. People have been losing their houses. I will leave for my colleagues to fill up on the other question. The Basket Fund is basically an attempt to pull the donor community. The donor community has been there, and we think that if they begin to pull their resources together with government, we might begin to see more traction. These people have been there. We are not proposing to invent them. They have been there. They are there right now. The intermediaries, these are organizations that exist. We are not going to establish new organizations. There are organizations that exist, like the, what is AULAI? What is the name? It's an University Law Clinics Association. Mm. AULAI Trust, University Law Clinics Association, the Social Change Assistance Trust here in Cape Town. There are many, there are a few other organizations like the Center for Community Justice and Development in Pietermaritzburg. There are a few other organizations, there are not many, that are providing these support services. I think I should pause now, my colleagues will run out of time.
Thank you. I think I will attempt to answer a few questions. One question was around the distribution of community advice offices, I think, which is very important. But for now, I think we do what we can with what we have. We would like to see a more spread of advice offices in each community. But maybe to mitigate that is that, for instance, the advice office in Mabopane is also having sign posters in other villages. Here is that whether it is feasible and sustainable to have an advice office in each community, or whether one advice office can have people spread into those areas where there is no advice office. This is part of the model. So, yeah, the distribution of community advice offices is an issue that we are working on, but it also depends on, funds. The other thing is around whether we are providing African solutions. In our work, I think we navigate between formal law and customary law, because our people are customary people. The cases that comes from court to an advice office, it's an indication that sometimes our jurisprudence, the English law and the Roman Dutch law, some of the answers of the African people are not in that. And so these cases then get referred to us. I'll give an example of two families who live on a communal land, but you find that there is no chief in that village because of the system has changed somehow. Now there is a dispute over land. If those people goes to court, the court wants proof that they own the land. And in the absence of that, sometimes that case gets kicked out of the court because the person who is claiming the land cannot produce proof. But if you go to that village, people will tell you that, no, Mr. Mjale has been living here. We know that he has been living there. And so our process of mediation is able to bring those people to a table where they can discuss their own solutions. So our approach is not that of the court per se. We don't do what the courts are doing. We are doing, our process are based on the indigenous systems of resolving disputes, but also recognizing the energy that is already there in those communities. Because people, when they are in conflict, they have some solutions in their mind, but it might be different solutions that through the mediation, you can then synchronize all that and come up with a solution that is lasting because it comes from the disputants themselves. I think I will stop here for now and perhaps give over to my friend.
Thanks, Chair. We really appreciate the questions and the comments that have come from the members, honorable members of the committee. Most of the issues have been addressed, including the issue of the intermediaries. I wanted to touch on that one to say they are already in existence, and it will be a matter if Legal Aid South Africa, for which I am a member of its board, agrees to take on this responsibility and maybe work out a model of when they have this added responsibility, should we go that route. And then how would the intermediaries help in the process of day-to-day management of the support given to community advice offices? On the issue of this African solution, I think my colleague Simbongile did touch on that, but safe to say that we have realized that there has been no link between the stakeholders that are playing in the community access to justice in the continent. Hence, since last year, we started a process of establishing an African Center of Excellence, which will be launched next week with our colleagues from DGRU, from the University of Cape Town, which seeks to encourage the sharing of experiences as the different countries around the continent. Because we believe that there is a rich experience that we have that can help us to improve on our how to facilitate access to justice, and also in terms of training and capacity building of the management committees of the various community-based advice offices, all as well as paralegals, in terms of them to be ready when the legislation comes into effect, then the issue of qualification, once that happens, then people would have at least have some form of a qualification, at least as a minimum, qualification to for one to practice as a paralegal. So I'm happy that the department has worked with us thus far to facilitate the issue of regulation of the committee-based advice offices and paralegal committee-based paralegals. I think once that process is finalized, and the modalities of facilitating funding, we could have an advice office sector that will be thriving in the near future. I also appreciate the links that the chairperson has indicated of the people that we could, and institution that we could work with to facilitate this work that we are doing. Thank you very much. My colleague, can you see that behind me? I don't know where. Okay. Okay.
I'm good.
Yes. Okay, great. I think we should move to our presentation.
Thanks, Chair. As I do that, let me just respond to issues which I think are very important. This Parliament passed the new Legal Aid Act in 2014. It's very solid, it's very sound. There's no need for legislation. I was just saying that in terms of our legal aid regime, legal aid provides legal assistance to indigent people or legal representation. It does not support institutions. So if we want to extend that mandate, then support other bodies as intermediary or whatever, it may require legislative mandate to do that. For now, it's got a direct link with the indigent people. And I think that law is very progressive, whatever. And it's very interesting, Chair, the regulation, what the Act did for the first time, to allow the minister to provide for regulations. I raised the issue of the land claimant from the perspective of the capacity, not the legislation. In fact, the regulation come into effect next week Tuesday, a week from today. Regulation made under the Legal Aid Act. I may just want to read Regulation 17 and 18, which talks to land restitution and land claims matter.
Before you check through you, before that is Kosana read that part, our notes that we've got here from the parliamentary committee say there's lack of recognition of the paralegal sector. And to that effect, the point we're making was, notwithstanding that there is such an act which Parliament passed in 2014, what does the department say about lack of recognition of the sector? That was the concern we raised.
Yes, I'll come to that. I just want to say that Legal Aid, Regulation 7, Legal Aid Sector may grant legal aid for access for cases under restriction of Land Rights Act, number 22 of 1994, if the Land Claims Commissioner makes funds available to Legal Aid South Africa to fund such matters. So, from next to Tuesday, Legal Aid South Africa will have the full competence to deal with legal aid matters. All is required is that there must be funds made available by the Chief Land Claims Commissioner to Legal Aid South Africa. And around the issue of tenancy, whatever, it goes further that...
Sorry, may I just ask a question while you're on that topic? Mr. Chair, are we going to be placed in possession of these regulations at some point? Does the committee get to read them? Do we have to wait until they're published?
Yes, they've been tabled. They're part of the law. They're just coming to operation.
Where were they tabled?
Chair, we addressed the committee a few months ago, I think.
The members of the committee also are entitled to forget because of heavy loads of work.
You also didn't remember, don't worry. You complain to have a heavy load.
So that's why I was just raising the point that legal aid already requires capacity to deal with issue of tenancy, issue of evictions, issue of land claims. Hence, I was saying that to extend that, maybe given more scope and more work, we have to look into issue of capacity. But the legislative regime is in place.
No, but you see, if you say legal aid included, if the national commissioner provides the funds, you can make a law like that. Because the office of the National Land Claims Commission has a fund which they are
unable even to administer. They employ a firm in Johannesburg to do that work for them. This is the money that must go to Legal Aid South Africa. It shouldn't be if. The money must go there. So I think you will have to adjust to the regulations to make it mandatory that the money must be made available to Legal Aid South Africa.
Fortunately, it's regulations, and I think they can be reworked as part of the implementation process to fit the objective of Parliament. I just want to make the point that there's no need to change the law. It's only if we want Legal Aid South Africa to fund other institutions, to be a conduit for funding, that may require some scope, whatever. And I was raising the point of practicals, for example, to say already Legal Aid South Africa, under its current legislation mandate, already engage employers paralegals.
No, that's not a comparable thing. It employs paralegals to assist their offices. But here we're talking about advice centers. And if I understand the recommendation, is that Legal Aid South Africa should be empowered like the Scottish Legal Aid to fund the advice centers. I think we must be specific there. The recommendation must be specific that we make provision for that.
Okay.
Yeah, and separate the paralegals.
Point taken,
Chen. Point taken, Chen. I think that can be what can be worked around. But what I was just saying is that already there's a need for and accept the need for use of paralegals in the system. Outside the pending the legislative reform that we are busy with, we have taken the point that the Legal Practice Act have intended to recognize the paralegal sector as a separate sector. But now the thing from the president we've made, that we are developing legislation, separate legislation, to deal with paralegals in terms of certain areas, etc. Outside the what we contemplated under the Legal Practice Act, etc. And that's the point we wanted to emphasize. Yes. So that will basically close the gap which was there when we passed the Legal Practice Act at that time, etc. Yes. So there will be a dedicated act that will deal with paralegals that will be promoted by the banks promoting, etc. Can I continue the presentation?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thanks, Chair. And let me also say that this presentation is closely linked with the previous one because it provides basically vehicles through which access to justice can basically become a reality and through which there can be better and optimal use of the alternative systems to the contemporary courts in terms of dealing with the... I see the weights are too small direct from here. The chair has already spoken from the background that the community court is an ancient, it's of ancient origin, it's not a new process, etc. And I think we've taken time to have it realized so that it can basically address some of the myriad of challenges we face on the justice system. And it embraces elements which are not there in the ordinary court dispensation. Elements of restorative justice, which lay emphasis on restitution, rehabilitation, offender reconciliation, community crime prevention, volunteer-based services for offenders and victims. The central focus is not the retribution of punishment, but it's in the healing of the breaches, the redressing of the imbalances, the restoration of the broken relationship, and the building of nationhood at the end of the day, etc. This kind of justice seeks to rehabilitate both the victims and the perpetrator, who should be given the opportunity to redress the infringement, etc. And all those elements are missing in the current punitive dispensation of the current contemporary court system, etc. I've said that the several concept it's of old origin. We at some point there was an initiative after 1994 for the South African Law Reform Commission to develop a blueprint or a legislative framework that will basically provide for the establishment of community courts, etc. They did a lot of research. There was a Pro 94, which was published in 1994, 1999, the document, etc., where they came with a views and submissions from the participant process. However, after they published the discussion document, I think the process was never taken to its finality. So we never came to a stage where there could be eventual legislation that provide the framework for this court, etc. So what we are doing now, we've started to revitalize the process so that we can take what the law reform could have started to take it to its logical conclusion, etc. But we're also taking what the law reform could have did together with lessons we've basically garnered over the time, etc. In 2004, the then president, in his State of the Nation address, President Begi, pronounced the establishment of the community courts, even outside the blueprint. And at that time, I think the department went ahead in terms of its pronouncement and established a infrastructure and avenues for those community courts to start operating. And the first one to be launched was the Hartsfield Community Court in next to the University of Pretoria, etc. And what was anticipated was that Hartsfield Community Court will give us some lessons which will lead us to preparing legislation so that we can eventually come to fruition of this community court. The reasons for the solution of the Hartsfield type community court was due to a need to establish a mechanism for expeditious resolution of petty crimes, which need not go to the formal courts. Diversion of certain offences, which are basically based the community, and also the involvement of communities in resolving some of the offences that basically are bearing our cost to the etc. And out of that process, we have developed a range of principles which we believe today that should be taken into consideration for informing the community courts proper. One, we believe that the community courts must basically inform the whole transformative imperative. They must basically take into account how do you transform the old order self-help community courts into proper community courts under the Constitution. That debate has not taken place, and the research we've undertaken is doing exactly that. We are building on what was there in the past and transforming that which was in the past to conform the Constitution today so that we don't start from scratch, because they were all communities organized in terms of this aspect around to community justice. Two, we also believe that the community courts will go a long way in restoring public confidence in the justice system, because it allows participation, it allows involvement, it basically is not only a state-sponsored process, it allows both parties, it also increases access to justice, it also incorporates community justice, it also increases community safety, it also entails a lot of corrective measures. As we have said, I think my colleague when he said earlier on, he said the mainstream courts, they are punitive, and all they are concerned with is about redressing in terms of jail, whatever. This one is basically how do you bring corrective measures to deal with those matters. When we went to the Hartsfield Community type, we thought that we can determine some of the categories of crimes or infringement or social ills that can be dealt with by the community court. That includes things like shoplifting, possession or use of drugs, especially by the youngsters. At the lower scale, not the drugs that basically get seized at the over time, etc. Housebreaking at low school, pickpocketing, theft from motor vehicles, public nuisance, trespassing, and all those. Those are kind of community ills that happens every day at the parks where people are grabbing cell phones and running with them, etc. And obviously, you want to sort out how do you, corrective measures and how you build communities rather than commit those offenders to prison. So those were the kind of offenses which were earmarked or intended for those hard-filled community types of offenses, etc. And magistrates and prosecutors will basically play a role of diversion around those offenses. But we always thought that we should also get more actors in the system, like justice of the peace, like religious communities, like respectable community leaders, elders who should basically be able to serve as role models and guide the youngsters in terms of conduct. And obviously, we also thought, like in the case of all the advice centers, that your appropriate funding model for community courts should also involve local government municipalities, because all these offices are happening at the local level. And we believe that this will lessen the caseload on the mainstream court. And basically, we also believe that the actors in the community court will be varied, will be varied, also include paralegals, will also include all those kind of, all those other people who are not basically accepted or who are not participating in the mainstream court, etc. Above all, community justice or community courts will basically lead to an enhanced cost reduction, because people go to those structures to go and get redress without basically putting putting their hands in their deeper pockets to pay for services, etc. We have done also, like the other presentation, there are quite a number of countries which have shown which have made advance around this issue, and we have started those kind of comparison. Jurisdictions such as Philippines, Rwanda, India, Mozambique, they've got well-established community courts. Bangladesh, Colombia, Peru, United States, Queensland, and more recently, Namibia, they've established those kind of courts. The model in Namibia is very interesting because it's basically a mixture of the traditional court scenario vis-a-vis the community courts are a dispensation. And basically that's informed by the rural and the urban setups, etc. It is for that reason, Chair, we've always advocated that community courts must go hand in hand with traditional court dispensation, because we believe that both of them, they share most of the elements, and basically they also involve public participation outside the court system, etc. So we're looking for that lessons we're going to get outside the community courts, lessons like community participation, exclusion of legal representation, issue of language used by those courts, issue of the locality and acceptance of those courts at the rural villages, whatever. We're going to be important elements that are going to build these courts, etc. Hence, we say that we are still looking forward to gather some lessons from the traditional courts perspective. What's the process moving forward around this, the development of legislation? The team which was established to draft the traditional courts continued to draft the concept or the blueprint for community courts. The team that worked on traditional courts has continued on the community court so that we can work on a similar thing. I came with Mr. Kodisbram Roque here, who's basically involved in the traditional courts and the community courts perspective, so that whatever lessons and whatever directive and guidance we get from here can basically filter down into our research, and we should be able basically to develop the other bill with speed. As I've said, it has taken us long to come to the traditional courts bill process. It should take us half the time or even a quarter of the time to come together with a community court blueprint or bill, because we have basically gained on much of the lessons that we'll have to take forward in terms of that. Research basically which is unfolding now focus mainly on desktop research and literature, and we also have some element of benchmarking with the other jurisdictions to make sure that the lessons, especially from the continent, are being taken forward in to ensuring that we are going to come with a perfect court model suited for the South African democracy. We believe that the research underway is going to provide sufficient policy options that could then be considered by this parliament and cabinet in terms of what model we're going to take forward, etc. And Chair, this is an important factor we also picked up during the research. We have had over years in this 1994. We have established community police forum, whose role is to ensure that there's local community participation in issues pertaining to crime. All this time, CPFs have been linked to police station in terms of asking police. We must create an avenue where CPFs get linked to advice offices, get linked to community courts, get linked to traditional courts, because all those are communal structures that deals with those matters at the local level. Now the emergence, the emergence of the police of revival of the street committees, or the ward committees, whatever, are going to add a more impetus in basically creating a more community-based a justice system where people can participate, etc. Anticipated time frame. We believe that we have done the research, and we have just been able to tweak it there and there once we have been guided by the outcome of international courts bill, etc. So we believe that with what we have done already, we should be able to commence with a process that should allow us to draft a community court bill, CCB. But Chair, we've also wanted to look at those courts as part of the broader reform of the justice system. They must not be seen in isolation. Remember, Parliament has passed the Superior Court Act. The Superior Court Act has been finalized. At the Lower Court Act, we still have to deal with the whole issue of the municipal courts, how they fit in the picture, the whole issue of the marshals court, the whole issue of the community court, so that at the end we've got a clear blueprint on how the lower courts, both in the formal structure, the municipal courts, and in the less adversarial, I don't want to call them informal, the less adversarial court structures which allow community participation are being structured, and all of them constitute a judicial landscape on access to justice. So that, like the Nigerian model, it provides what in Nigeria is called the multi-door approach. People have got opportunities to approach all the myriad of structures in place to get redress. And our court annex mediation, Honorable Breitenbach, is also part of the process. We will share with this committee the report out of the panel. In fact, this financial year, Chair, we have put it as part of our APP, that we will roll out the court annex mediation to 30 court centers countrywide. And we've earmarked those court centers to be the regional courts. We want to say at the regional courts which have now been entrusted with civil jurisdiction, in particular family law disputes and divorce matters, it will provide more opportunity to extend the court annex mediation in those centers where we've already created capacity in terms of registrars, whatever. So this part of the broader multifaceted approach towards access to justice to ensure that people at the end of the day can basically have more access to justice and basically leverage the opportunities that come out of the new constitutional framework. And at the end, this will also be seen in the broader context of the Renaissance project, change the legal system. These are the structures, but they must all build into how we create a legal system that addresses the value system post-1994. I don't know if my colleagues want to add some few things on what I've presented.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Honorable members,
the floor is open. Honorable Martin.
Well, sir, I don't know in our language, why do we separate community from tradition? Why can't we merge the two and call the envisaged court system a traditional community base? Because it's like we are creating more layers of court systems which, if it were to be infused into one, will serve the same purpose. I'm asking this question because Mrs. Kosana proposes a process in which the traditional court bill is passed by Parliament and look at its implications, learn from its implementation process, and then thereafter consider the community court be? Why don't you? What is the logic or the rationale behind separating the two? Wouldn't it serve the same purpose if the two were to be merged into? My last point. I was listening to the Minister of Police in his various interviews about, and this is informed by the analysis you are making on the role of different role players, community, policing forum, and street committees, and so forth and so on. He's making analysis. He makes a point, and he says about combating crime, because part of what we need to do as this committee is to how do we formulate legislation towards criminal justice system, part of which is combating crime. And the minister says police will only act in situation where an agency has arisen. And in the absence of agency, police can't act. Perhaps that was in the context of him justifying why the police could not act on the despicable acts of the Deputy Minister of Higher Education. But our approach, and in how we formulate legislation and regulatory interventions and mechanisms, should empower agencies such as the police and various agencies to combat crime, and even to create mechanisms which will preempt if incidents of crime may or may not occur, because we believe in the principle that prevention is better than cure. So as we formulate legislation such as this, higher upmost in our minds is prevention of incidents of crime than to wait for crime to occur, justify the existence of agency, and then call upon our institutions and agencies to only act then. So the formula and the model that you have now mentioned of bringing together various actors in communities augurs well in the spirit of combating crime. But my only worry is when you bracket together various forms of crimes, which you call petty crime, and you bracket together what is called housebreaking and theft from vehicles, I find that to be serious crimes, because often than not, they result into death, or they result into injuries, loss of life. At what point would you consider housebreaking and theft from vehicles as serious, not a petty crime? How about if you were to include in this bracket what I think some of the colleagues will remember during apartheid was what was called Wagengate, but that was designed specifically to dissuade people from roaming around and not doing anything meaningful. So there were bylaws in the past, one of which was called in Afrikaans Wagengate, waiting aimlessly and not knowing what to do. Then it was because the economy was able to absorb many people and into various forms of employment, and the system could not allow people just to roam around, loafering around. And maybe those bylaws were in the Afrikaner province, such as the Oranje Free State and Transvaal. I don't know those who are from Natal and the Cape, but there was such a bylaw. Perhaps that should be one of the bylaws which must be considered, that people should be encouraged to go and find work. And perhaps that will also inspire government to create job opportunities so that people don't stand around Wagengate, or such a bylaw. Such laws must be considered. And from this bracket, I think it would be good if you delete housebreaking and theft from the agency.
You know, just as a follow-up to what Honorable Matthias says, it is always helpful to go back into history. 1984-85, the University of South Africa did research. Then it was about people's courts, which were actually community courts. And the finding was that African people in the townships created makgotla, which were community courts. They imported the African jurisprudence from the rural areas into the towns. And now, therefore, the makgotla or community courts in the townships were really the traditional courts in another city. And as Honorable Matthias, I think, correctly says, why do can't we talk about community courts which would apply in both rural and urban areas? Why do we want to say the other one is tradition, the other one is community? But theoretically, we also talk about traditional communities and urban communities. Why can't we get the concepts right? So I think that's something that what Honorable Matthias is saying is something that we must go and engage with and clarify the concepts, because otherwise we create too many layers and so on. Any other honorable?
Yes. I listened to you when you said how you make your research. You said, talked about desktop and going to other countries. I think you will be advised before everybody goes that you listen to the elders, people over 70 and up to 100 where you do get before they go. Secondly, there is what is called customary law, which the Europeans accepted to be what they call law that was practiced by Africans, and then what is actually true African law. There's a distinction between those. It had to be accepted as by the government, and it was written and taught at school. And when people talk about customary law, they mean that. Now there is a law which is an African law, which is different. Thirdly, the pillar of the African law is a strong family tie. The aim is to include the whole family in the activities and actions and the wrongdoings of their son or daughter. Now you have got the family, the aim of the colonialists was to destroy the African family to nothing. Even your constitution has got a very great effect to that. It is based on the European way of life, not African. So I'm trying to find out. I'm really sympathetic with you. I think I sympathize with you in your endeavors. I think you have got a big problem in front of you. Let me just give you one example. No crime earlier on was for European cause, it was for everybody. I mean, for Africans. There was no prison. Even if you kill somebody, there was a solution to that in the family. Members of the family would say, okay, uvusa inhloko yalamba, which means now you are making that person as if he's alive, the one that you have killed. Now that family must provide some cattle or money or whatever, such that that family does not suffer as a result of the death of their mother. It is more reparative. I'm saying, now you are trying to do this thing, but the environment which you are doing it is different. There is some kind of, there is no community family ties now. I'm an independent person. Now you've got police who are supposed to be looking after the independent people. And yet you are now talking about traditional, I don't know which tradition you're talking about. And I don't understand, mainly. But I've looked at what you call the traditional court, bill and so on. I still have problems with it. Because I'm saying the environment in which you are in, if my child is no more part of my family, because in European way, your child is your child up till the age of 16. And after that, you have no responsibility. You can even chase him out of your house. So the state takes care of that. In the African law, that's part and part of the family right. And there are rules that you must, the do's and don'ts in that family. And these are the rules that you say, the do's and don'ts of the family, which are traditional values of the African. Now, the question I'm asking, as I say, I want to find out the environment in which you're talking about and the so-called African law that you are using. Which one? Is it the customary law as accepted by the Europeans? Or is it the African law, and which was mainly based on the unity of family? You talk about that. When that one is gone, how do you put that? Thank you.
We should have written a book on this. And we should have been given a professorship for it. But you see, we expect of government to implement. I don't think there is anything that we still need to know that you don't know and you haven't told us. But I think that government is either not having a capacity or government doesn't take this matter seriously. Mm-hmm. You know, to say 1994, the matter was on the agenda. This is 2017. We are still talking about the matter. And you see, this whole question of community justice actually was started by O.R. Tambo and Nelson Mandela in their law firm, because they established a law firm to deal with the problems of the people without pay. Bram Fischer, Joe Slovo, all those people were doing community justice. They were also doing what paralegals should be doing. And a democratic government set up in 1994 by Mandela, who is the champion of this thing, seems not to be able to know where to start to implement this thing. If you can look at the money that we have spent going all over the world doing research, that money could actually maybe have just been used to build houses, because there is no product that is implementable in this manner. And also, a pilot project is made in Hatfield. The community courts were started in Mamelodi, in Tembisa, in Soweto. Why does the pilot project go to Hatfield? For whom? To do what with that? And also, the concept of that Hatfield project doesn't seem to be something that is advancing community courts as envisaged by the people, as piloted by the people themselves. And
we still have people like Dr. Zola Skweyiya, who were tasked by Tambo to deal with this matter and even to provide funding. We have people like Judge Albie Sachs, who are still around. We have people like Professor Maquid Mason, who is implementing these ideas in Sierra Leone, Malawi, and other places. But South Africa, where the ideas originated, there is no progress. Now, if we can sit and quantify the people that were employed from 1994 until today to implement these ideas, and the amount of money, the salaries and the benefits that we have paid them, it can be qualified as a, you know, what do you call them, the term, wasted expenditure. Paying people for 20 years. Fruitless expenditure for 20 years, and there are no fruits in the whole thing. No, I think we have to change tune. I also remember, and it has been drawn to my attention, that in March we requested the department to organize a conference on community law and access to justice. March now is August, and there's no mention of that conference. So I would think that as this committee, we must take over that conference, organize it. We get the Foundation for Human Rights and all the stakeholders that we have mentioned here, universities, Dalai Lama Institute, Human Rights Research Council, because if you look at the crisis situation of the women right now, we are talking about women that are being killed as parastatal in communities, and the people who live in the communities are these paralegal people, but they are not funded, they don't have resources to intervene, and the police are busy with inconclusive investigations. So I think this matter area we're dealing with is really very urgent, and we need to come up with something before the end of the year. And we also need a technical committee. Bring people like Professor Maquid Mason, these professors at UWC, University of Cape Town. They must look at legislation. Before the end of the year, we need a legislation on paralegals and how they're going to be funded and all this. We need legislation on traditional courts. The other thing was that the point of Honorable Mateisen, we have to look at why don't we fuse community courts and traditional courts and have one thing and then move forward. So I think from our office we will come with a proposal of how we approach it. We'll share it with all of you, and then we will also request you to identify other role players, if you know of them, so that by October we have a conference that will come out with the draft legislation. So if the department is slow, we'll make it a committee bill. We need to move, because we cannot have a situation where women are being killed, they are being abused. Everybody who wants to be prominent, they make big speeches about women that are being abused, but government has the resources to take action. The only action that we take is to make speeches about these women that are being abused. Now we're tired of speeches, we want the law, a law that can bite. So we'll come back to ourselves with the proposals. And then let's work together and not have spaces, everybody wanting their turf to say this is my space, but out of this space nothing comes. Honorable Advocate Skosana, are you happy with that proposal?
I'm happy, and we'll put everything in place to start to work with your office, Mr. Chair, to get things off the ground. So for that reason, I said to Mr. Amorok, we are going to come back here. We have done a lot of work. We must just put in a program, and that guidance you are giving us will take us forward. And I would like to say that the minister do take this matter to heart. In fact, they constitute part of the broader concept of the reform of the legal system. And I think
that's where I disagree with you. Once we say we want it to be part of the broader legal system, we will never get any results. You know, Minister Hadjet started with the transformation of the judiciary, but that process left out traditional courts as part of the judiciary. It left out community courts as part of the judiciary. Now, if we are broadening it again, let's focus on what is before us. It is paralegal, traditional courts, it's community courts. And we used to call that an alternative legal system. Let's focus on that. By the end of the year, we meet with the product on the table. We need to have this advice centers funded, because the money is there. The money is there, they must be funded and made to operate. So I think we make sure that the council that you are represented in the working committee, and then we'll get the technical people that can help with the do you understand?
Thank you, Chair. I don't think it's my place to speak as I am doing, but just to in order so that we can anticipate potential spaces for collaboration. ACAOSA and its partners are already organizing a stakeholder colloquium that was going to focus on the regulation of the cow sector, and I think if we can mobilize the right energies, this that you are raising could be catered for.
You see the mistake there. You will become a talk shop. You don't have the capacity to implement the outcome of your talk shop.
Mm.
Now we want the government and parliament to be involved, because the government can initiate a bill, but if the government is not initiating bills on time, Parliament can initiate bills.
Hmm.
So you want to organize a talk shop, that you can talk inside the process that we are proposing.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think that was the point.
Yeah, so...
To match.
That's why I say you should be represented in the team that the department and Parliament will be putting together.
Okay.
Some of us wants to retire. And before we retire, we don't want to be told that we didn't finish the job that we were elected to do. Yes. Okay, any comments? We leave it at that. You see, Ms. Majake, Honorable Majake, is fighting me because she thinks I support these traditional things that oppress women, and things that we are not moving fast on women, and I agree with her, but... I can't just agree. There must be action. Honorable Majak.
At the appropriate time, Honorable Chair, I will actually talk to what you are now alluding to.
Okay, I think we, Advocate, I think your name was mentioned so many times. You say something. We know your name. So where are you before?
I was at the Ministers Commission, before then I was at IT, before then I was at
Well, we're going there as a discussion. No, you're welcome. You'll help us because
Honourable Gwydion that likes to prosecute okay, I think we should
Chair, thanks. I think your last statement that you made before the Honourable Member spoke, saying that you would want to organise this conference before the end of the year and where action should be taken, and your last statement was that resources are there, money is there, why community advice offices are not funded.
Exactly, that's why I want to bring all the stakeholders, because everybody has the money there and there's no common program that is a national agenda. We want a national agenda that will
come. We have long waited to hear that coming from the portfolio committee and from a department. We know when that happens, resources made available to this sector, we'll be talking a different language. Thank you so much for that statement.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chair.
Thank you.